Hi, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, June 25th, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Jody Kretzman, continuing his series on community, building strong communities, lessons from a journey. Let's listen in.
Here, and good morning to the Tate Ministry. My name is Jody Kretzman, and I'm here from Chicago. This is a session called Building Strong Communities. It's the first of a series this week on that theme. In the next three versions of this, on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, we'll be exploring a variety of stories and lessons that I've learned on a journey, a kind of odyssey that I want to tell you about for a little while this morning. I think as we're sitting in here, we're now losing our village musicians. Tom and Mary are leaving out the window there. So we may have a chorus of wah, wah, wah as we begin here, I think. I don't know if anybody wants to break off and begin singing in the middle of this introductory session. That would be fine. I'm going to be referring to two or talking around two books in the next few sessions. One is a book that came out about 2 years ago that I did with a colleague of mine, John McKnight, called Building Communities from the Inside Out, and the bookstore has instructed us to make sure that we mention these and hold them up so that people know that they're available. And I'll tell you a little bit of the story about Building Communities from the Inside Out this morning and what's happened to us around that book. And the other one I'd like to call your attention to is a book called The Careless Society, Community and Its Counterfeits by my longtime colleague, John McKnight. McKnight is, in my view, one of the most trenchant social critics in the Western world these days. He's worked for many long years with people like Ivan Illich. And most of his stuff over the years has been published in obscure little magazines. Actually, probably not so obscure to some of the people in this room, but places like The Other Side, right, which is not a mainstream academic journal, exactly. And so finally, about 6 months ago, a lot of John's stuff over the last 20 years has been collected between...
What's the name of the journal?
It's called The Careless Society, Community and Its Counterfeits. And it's also available in the bookstore. I think I've got one or two pieces in it that John and I did together, but I highly recommend it for a really critical look at some of our institutional fallacies as we've come to understand them over the last 20 years. Let me give you a little background. What I'd like to do this morning is to kind of sort of set the scene for some discussions and see if we can get all on the same page here for the next week. And to tell you a few stories about what really has been an astonishing journey for us over the last few years. The journey we've been on, we've been walking with a number of people, including lots of people here at Holden. Ted and Ron and their colleagues in Tacoma have been teaching us about community building over the last number of years, and we've been in continual dialogue as this stuff gets worked on. There are lots of people here at Holden Village that over the last 20 years have been important teachers of mine about what community might be and how we might be thinking about community as we move into the 21st century. So this really, the work I want to talk with you about is not my work, it is our work. It is a work that's being invented in communities across the United States. And I think the spirit that I want to make sure we have in the room about this work is to recognize that it is not a codified kind of clear model, but that it is a set of paths that people are inventing. The last sentence of Building Communities from the Inside Out tries to capture that sense of invention. We quote our friends in Mondragon, Spain. Has anybody here visited the Mondragon cooperatives over the years? That Mondragon is probably the most thoroughgoing reinvention of economy and society in Western industrial countries. And it's a network of cooperatives. And there, when you go to Mondragon, you see over virtually every enterprise their slogan. And their slogan says, we build the path as we walk it. We build the path as we walk it. Nobody's been there before us, right? We are the people with the scythes cutting down the underbrush ahead of us. That's the kind of spirit I think we've been trying to pursue this community building work with over the last few years. Let me give you a little bit of background. I've lived for almost the last 30 years in the city I was born in, Chicago. And although time is at a university, I'm currently at Northwestern University at a place called the Center for Urban Affairs and Policy Research. By the way, some of you on the West Coast may know that Northwestern is primarily known as a famous football school. For those of you who don't know, we went for the first time in about three millennia to the Rose Bowl last year. I know it'll probably be at least another millennium by the time we go again. You don't think so? Okay. Well, I do want to take my one chance here at apologizing for working at a football factory, so I will do that. I'm really sorry. The Center for Urban Affairs there, though, has always been a little bit unusual because we've had a corner of it where a little group of us over the last 25 years have been associated and we have tried to ask a different kind of question about communities, and particularly communities in trouble. What we've been interested in asking about is the question, how do local communities solve problems? Now that sounds like a simple and logical question to ask, how do local communities solve problems, until you start thinking about how unusual it is, at least in the academy, for that question to be phrased in that way. Most of the last 50 years in universities, people have been focused on exactly the opposite question. That is, how do local communities cause problems? And therefore, what sorts of large systems and institutions do we need to construct to sweep up after the mess caused by local communities? That's been, I think, probably the standard approach by most academics. We, though, have always been focused on the other kind of question, and so we've been very interested in the tools and methods, particularly in cities, but in the last few years in smaller communities as well. That folks have invented to rebuild communities. We've been, if I think sort of about the four main tools for community problem solving over the last century in the United States, I would start, probably because I'm in Chicago, but I think this is true nationally too, I would start with Jane Addams and the Settlement House movement in the late 19th century. The idea that you could put a center in the middle of a community where folks who were trying to adapt to an entirely new and alien and alienating culture could begin to bring their own strengths and connect together and become a part of that culture. The second great invention, I think, in terms of urban community building was the development over the years, which a number of people here are involved in these days, of the community organizing movement. In Chicago, it was carried for a long time on the backs of a guy named Saul Alinsky, who had the idea that you could take the lessons learned in the labor movement and translate them into communities, that you could figure out how some of the same tools that gave working people a voice in their workplace could be used in communities to give people a voice in the communities that they lived in, particularly with respect to the powerful private and public institutions that affected their communities. And I hope during the week that a number of us here who have been close to community organizing over the last 20 or 30 years can be in discussion about that and how that's changing these days. And then in the late 1960s, early 1970s, a whole bunch of folks, mostly out of the community, organized. There's the song, I Knew It Would Happen. We'll just pause for a minute here. It's all right. This is about community, and so is that. Messy, right? That there's right. That's right. We want clean systems, right? And hierarchies and formal structures. And communities always have this messy stuff about them, right? Right.
people.
Right. Do you think they'll be able to hold this to under an hour? Talking about community problem-solving tools. There goes the bus. And the discovery, really, at the end of the 1960s and the beginning of the 1970s, that that a lot of problems of communities had to do at their core with economic conditions, with a huge shift in a global economy that was leaving more and more communities behind, and impoverishing folks who used to have a way into the economy, and as a result, a lot of community organizing effort in the late 1960s and early 70s went into the invention then of community development corporations. The whole community economic development movement began taking root. And so today, 25 years later, we've got in the United States about 2,200 community development corporations. And they are the major engines which produce housing for lower income people in the United States. The private market doesn't do that. The public sector doesn't do that. Local community development corporations do that primarily. And that really is a community-based invention of the last 25 years. So that was the third invention we'd been interested in. And then the fourth, I think, has been emerging more and more powerfully over the last 15 years and combining with the settlement house, community organizing, and community development to give a new dimension to what's going on in a lot of cities. And that is the attention that's being given for the last decade or so to community planning, to putting together a kind of table at the local community level which could envision a future for particularly communities in trouble and which could then envision a kind of strategy for getting those communities to the table to begin to affect that future. So we've always been interested at the Center for Urban Affairs in the community problem-solving tools that that folks have invented. The work that we've been doing over the years took a turn about 7 years ago, which has been incredibly exciting and a ride that is still, in fact, going on. What happened about 7 years ago is that my colleague McKnight and I and Charles Payne, who's the director of the head of African American Studies at Northwestern, the three of us got a grant essentially to hit the road and to begin visiting mostly the 25 largest cities around the United States, but lots of other communities as well. In those cities, our destinations were not, in fact, the usual tourist places, but were the communities within those cities that were the most devastated, most clearly up against it in some very challenging kinds of ways. So we spent an awful lot of time in places like the South Bronx in New York City and Roxbury in Boston and South Central Los Angeles and the east side of Detroit, north side of St. Louis, Liberty City in Miami, public housing all over the place, a little bit of time in places like Tacoma with Ron and Ted and others. What we were doing, though, in those places was what made the journey so exciting and so absolutely exhilarating and why it is I consider it such a blessing these days. We were asking local folks to tell us stories, not about, usually, the terrific challenges that they faced, but about what was working, what was succeeding in the face of incredible challenges in these communities. What was it in the South Bronx or in Roxbury or in South Central Los Angeles that was giving people hope? How could you begin to collect a set of stories that allow people to think that this place has a future, and that if I were to think about a granddaughter or grandson that I loved, and I thought about that granddaughter or grandson being successful, I could even think about her or him staying here in this place and not moving out, not having to leave the South Bronx or even public housing, various places. The wonderful news is that there are, when you look for them, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of those stories, of success stories in unlikely places. And what the Green Book is a report of at least scores, if not hundreds, of those stories, and an attempt to report out then the discussions that we had with community leaders across the United States and some in Canada about what are the lessons from these stories. If you studied success and began trying to extract the themes from them, what could we learn about building communities in the late 20th century for the 21st century? What lessons and themes were there? Some of the stories, let me just tell you a few. Some of the stories you know about, and they're big stories for people who are interested in community building in cities or any other places. One of the places a number of you know that I continue to learn an immense amount from is a place on the west side of Chicago. Chicago, my town, has 77 neighborhoods, and this is the third poorest of the 77 neighborhoods, a neighborhood called West Garfield Park. And there's a little church there, happens to be a Lutheran church, that 15 years ago had dwindled to 38 people. And these 38 people had to face a choice about whether they closed their doors and gave up, like a whole lot of churches had done in the city, or whether they stay. And they thought about that long and hard and prayed about it, and finally decided that they would stay. But they conditioned their decision on some very interesting commitments. They said, if we're going to stay, we're no longer going to be just a Sunday morning place. We're going to be a 7-day-a-week place, probably a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week place. And we're going to learn how to be effective community builders here. Either we learn how to do that, or then we'll close our doors. Well, what did they do? They did what I now think any good community builder does. They looked around the room and they said, what do we have here to build on? Where are the building blocks? It's a logical question, right? All they saw was the 38 people sitting in the room. That was pretty much it. They looked slightly further, though, and saw that the room they were sitting in was mortgage-free. The church had been paid off. They immediately remortgaged their church. And with the proceeds, they bought the worst-looking building in the immediate area. It was a three-flat, three-apartment building down the block, which is abandoned, rat-infested, used by crack dealers, falling down in lots of places. And for the next 6 months, these 38 people, after church on Sunday morning, spent the rest of their Sundays together down the block with hammers and nails and saws and vats of soup rebuilding this apartment building. And after 6 months, they had a building that was by far the jewel of the neighborhood. Right? It was the best looking building there. And they also had picked up a lot of skills in carpentry and plumbing and painting and drywalling and so on. What they did then was to rent the building out, and with the proceeds they bought a second one and they did it again. This time it took only 2.5 months because they learned something the first time around, right? And they did it again and again, and this was 15 years ago, and now this little church of 38 people is a community development corporation that does about $11 million a year of business. This little church has rehabilitated or built anew over 1,000 units of affordable housing in West Garfield Park. This little church now employs about 500 people and has started over 20 businesses in West Garfield Park. Right? This little church is clearly now, by the way, not so little. It's sort of hard to get in on Sunday mornings. They got a couple of services now. It's Bethel New Life on the west side of Chicago. Lots of you know about Bethel and know a lot about the folks who've been there over the years. They've been at Holden, too, telling their stories. It really is now a beacon of hope, not only for Chicago, but for folks across the United States. And we've learned an immense amount about community building from Bethel. I want to tell you one of the big stories, because there are some resources available on this next one that I want to really recommend to you. In Roxbury in Boston, where I've spent a lot of time, there is a wonderful group called the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative. Anybody heard about Dudley Street? Anybody here know? Dudley Street is an area of Roxbury, which is the poorest part of Boston, which is a wonderfully rich area, although poor economically. It's an area that is about 2 miles from downtown Boston, and it's a third African American, a third Latino, mostly people from Puerto Rico, and a third Cape Verdean, right? People from the Cape Verde Islands off the coast of Africa. One of the things that this means in the Dudley Street neighborhood is that all meetings take place in three languages, right? English and Spanish and Cape Verdean Creole. So that when you go to meetings in Dudley Street, you know you're going to be there till 1 in the morning, right? They do take a while, but that's their commitment to make sure that everybody's language is included in these meetings. Well, what happened in Dudley Street is that people in the neighborhood looked up about 12 years ago and saw downtown Boston advancing on them. And they did a little research, and what they discovered was that that all of the city officials, the mayor and the city fathers, there weren't very many mothers in those days, had plans for their neighborhood, about what their neighborhood ought to be about, right? And the plans didn't seem to include them. There was a lot of new housing that was going to be unaffordable to the people who lived in this neighborhood. They did a little bit more research, and they found that all the private developers in Boston also had plans for their neighborhoods about the expansion of the downtown business district into the edge of Roxbury where they lived. And what they finally decided was that everybody in Boston had a plan for their neighborhood but them, and that it was therefore time for them to put together their own plan. And that's what they did. And they put together what we think is the most deeply rooted, democratically processed planning effort that we know about any place. They went household to household. They spent 3 years at it. They got people together consistently around questions of what do we want this place to look like in 20 years? What's the vision here? And how might we then put together the strategies to make the vision work? At the end of 3 years, they had a plan. They did hire a couple of people to help them make it look fairly spiffy so that they could show it to the outside world. They took their plan then, these neighborhood folks, very poor neighborhood people, down to City Hall, and they showed the mayor and city council their plan, and they basically said to them, our plan is better than your plan, Mr. Mayor. Why don't you adopt our plan as your plan? And they did the politics around that and embarrassed the mayor and the city council a little bit, did some good organizing, and they got finally the city fathers of Boston said, that's right, your plan is better than ours. We'll adopt it. And they had an official ceremony in which their plan was adopted as the official plan for the Dudley Street neighborhood in Boston. But they didn't stop there. And this is the astonishing part to me. They then asked, what do we need in terms of tools to rebuild our neighborhood here? And they started thinking about the investment capital that they needed and the variety of business opportunities that were there in rebuilding their neighborhood. But what they finally focused on was the fact that about 33% of their land, about a third of their land, was empty. Used to have buildings on it, but arson for profit and a whole lot of other forms of depopulating neighborhoods had blown through Roxbury. And a lot of land was vacant. And what they finally decided was that we'll go back to the city of Boston and we will ask them to give to us, this neighborhood group, a power which they have called the power of eminent domain, right? Government has the power to take land for public uses. And in the only case we know about nationally, this scruffy little neighborhood group went to the city of Boston and did their politics and organizing again and got, in fact, the city of Boston to grant them the power of eminent domain, a major shift in authority and governance to the neighborhood level. And now when you go back to Roxbury in this area, you see the fruits of that effort. You see the housing having been raised up out of the rubble-strewn lots, and you see the commercial strips coming back to life. And at the center of it, at the center of it is a community center. And the community center was planned over a year and a half by the young people of the neighborhood. Over 70 teenagers got together with two architects in the neighborhood and learned architecture. And then the teenagers went door to door in the neighborhood, asked everybody what they wanted to see in a community center, and the young people designed the community center. And then they presented it to the community in a big ceremony, and now the community center is being built, owned by everybody. Well, that's the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative. I partly mention it because there's a wonderful book about this effort called Streets of Hope. Streets of Hope, The Fall and Rise of an Urban Neighborhood, by Peter Medoff and Holly Squaw. It's about a year old, Medoff and Squaw. Streets of Hope. When I think about this book, we digress for just a second, I think about Peter Medoff. Medoff was a good friend of ours. He was the first director of the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative, and he left about 6 years ago so that the directorship could be taken over by a local resident in Dudley Street. He himself had not lived in Dudley Street until he became director. And when Peter left, he left partly to write a book about the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative, and did. Streets of Hope is out. When it came out a year ago, there was a big celebration in Boston. The mayor came, and hundreds of people came and celebrated with Peter and Holly the publication of this book. And Peter was just incredibly pleased with himself and with the effort of Dudley Street, and that he went home, and the next morning he died of AIDS. So when you read Streets of Hope, know that there's an entire life that's in that book as well. I also mentioned the Dudley Street effort because there is now available an hour-long video on the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative called Holding Ground, which is available. I'll try to get the address from Boston, and they're now negotiating with the public broadcasting to have it shown nationally sometime in the fall. So you might look for Holding Ground to come up. Another very hopeful story from this odyssey. Well, there are a number of these big stories. That's a multi-million dollar story. Hundreds of millions in Dudley Street. So is the Garfield Park one. A lot of those big stories out there. But I think when I think about the years we spent on the road collecting success stories, I think about the smaller ones a lot. I think about the block by block, church by church efforts of people to take back their communities. And what they have in common is that folks are saying all over, you know, we could wait for Washington, D.C. or for Olympia to do something productive in our community, and we will probably be waiting until the 22nd century if we do that, right? If somebody's going to do something about our community, it's going to be us, nobody else. Now, one of the things that's become so evident to us over the last few years is that this pervasive idea that communities are mainly places that cause problems, which other people have to sweep up, rather than places that solve problems, is a relatively new idea that we've been working on this hard in the United States for about 40 or 50 years. But that before the last 40 or 50 years, there are centuries of wisdom about community building. We have all kinds of those stories, right, in our own tradition. Ted's going to preach on the feeding of the 5,000 later on in the summer, he tells me. I mean, there's a story about community building. There's a story in which Jesus decides that the only way to feed 5,000 people is to put them into small groups, right? And it's like he's an IAF organizer. I mean, he understands that people have to do one-on-ones together and know each other by name and face. And when he looks at the whole 5,000, all they'll produce is, what, two fishes and five loaves. And the minute they get in small groups, all of a sudden, you've got an incredible number of loaves and fishes being produced. Is that some silly miracle like I thought in Sunday school? Maybe not. Maybe folk had those loaves and fishes all the time, and all they needed to do was to get to know each other a little bit before they came out of the back pocket, right? Mm-hmm. People give when we know, when we're connected with each other. So there are lots of wisdom stories, it seems to us, in our own Judeo-Christian tradition, but there are stories in other traditions as well, and some of you know that I have a favorite one not from the Christian tradition that I do want to tell, because I never tire of telling it, and I want to make sure that I get a chance to do it. Here's my favorite community building story of all time, just flat out. Can we do this, Ron? This is from the Sufi Muslim tradition. People here know Sufi stories, right? I think people up at Holden have done Sufi stories over the years. This is a typical Sufi story in that it, unlike our own stories, it starts with a moral, right? There is no suspense here. The moral's right at the beginning, and then the story elaborates on the moral. This is my favorite community building story of all time. For those of you with teachers, it's a humbling story as well. Here's the moral. The moral is you will only learn what you already know. Got it? You will only learn what you already know. Here's the story. The village elders had failed time after time to resolve a difficult problem. And so they invited a very wise person from another village to come and help them. And in time she came. And people gathered to hear her wisdom. And when they gathered, the wise woman asked the gathered villagers, "Do you know what I'm going to tell you?" And in unison, the villagers replied, "No, we wouldn't have asked you if we knew." And so the wise woman replied, "You will only learn what you already know. And if you don't know what I'm going to tell you, I'm leaving." And she left. And the village was in an uproar. All of the local pastors began calling meetings and trying to organize the villagers into activity. Finally organized themselves and asked the wise woman back for a second visit. And she came. And once again, she asked the gathered villagers, "Do you know what I'm going to tell you?" And this time they'd been so well organized. in unison, they all shouted, "Yes!" And she looked out at them and she said, "Well, if you already know, then I have nothing at all left to tell you." And she left, right? And the village became even more frustrated. More meetings, more frequent and longer meetings. And after many months, they issued a third invitation. And again, the wise woman came, and this time they were ready. And she asked once again, "Do you know what I'm going to tell you?" And this time, they were very ready. In unison, half of the villagers shouted, "Yes," and half of the villagers shouted, "No." So the wise woman looked out at the gathered villagers, and she said, "Now, will all of those who know what I'm going to tell you, tell everybody who doesn't know? And that way we'll all know." And she left. She never came back again. It was the end of the wise woman. And that night, a leader in the village had a dream, which she reported out to the gathered villagers the next morning at breakfast announcements. And she said, "Last night a voice appeared to me in my dream and told me the meaning of the message from the wise woman." She said, "The wise woman was trying to teach us that any really important knowledge was already here in our village, in our culture, in our traditions, and most importantly, in our relationships with each other, and not in outside experts from other villages," right? He said, "We already know. The only thing we don't have is the confidence to believe that we know." Okay? That's a Sufi story. 7 centuries ago, as far as I can tell, villages of the Middle East, and what I want to report to you is that that story, I think, is as relevant to the United States and our communities here in 1996 as it was to the Middle East 7 centuries ago. And that where people have, in fact, discovered the power of local knowledge and the relationships which bring that knowledge into activity, astonishing things happen, right? Why is this ancient wisdom so difficult for us to attain? I think for me, the answer to that question was most clearly put by a woman who became a great teacher of mine, as so many community people have been, whom I want to tell you about next for just a second. This is a woman whom I met on in the years before this odyssey, but visited often during this odyssey. And I want to remember her for you because she died last August, and I'm trying to keep her memory alive for a little while. She died at the age of 81. Her name was Mrs. Margaret Edna Johnson. Mrs. Johnson was an African-American woman who lived for her entire life in the South Bronx in New York City. And you probably know people like Mrs. Johnson because she is a person who was at the center of every good thing that ever happened in the South Bronx, right? When schools were built, she was there. When churches came back to life, she was there. When community policing was introduced, she was there. When young people were invited back into the center of community life, Mrs. Johnson was there. And she had shown me over the years incredible stuff going on in the South Bronx, lots of good organizing stuff, lots of good development stuff. But I had never asked her a question that I asked her about 7 years ago, sitting on her front stoop. And it was a question that opened up with great clarity what I think now is the central message of the Green Book. We were sitting on her front steps looking out at the South Bronx. And we were looking at a scene of contrast, rubble, but also wonderful, colorful new housing that she had built and her group, Banana Kelly, had built. In the course of our discussion, I finally got around to asking a question that I didn't usually ask people until I knew them really well. I said, "Mrs. Johnson, you've lived here all of your life in the South Bronx, and you've seen it go from communities that really were working here to a community that all of a sudden was the symbol of urban decay for all of the United States, right? Was the place where presidential candidates have always come during their campaigns and never after they were elected, right? This is what the South Bronx has become. Why? What do you think happened here?" is what I asked. What happened in the South Bronx? And she thought for a few minutes. She's a very, very thoughtful woman, and she finally said, "Jody, probably the worst thing that ever happened to us here in the South Bronx is that we got put into a prison." And nobody had said that to me before, and I wondered what she meant, and I asked her to say some more. And she said, well, the prison I'm talking about is not a prison that's made up of high walls with barbed wire and machine guns at the top. She said, this was 7 years ago, she said in her view that there were enough of those, we didn't need any more. But she said, the prison I'm talking about, and this is the phrase that's been with me ever since, is a prison that's made up of other people's ideas about who we are. Right? It's a prison made up of other people's ideas about who we are in the South Bronx. Did you hear that? Right? I thought I had heard something fairly important. I asked Mrs. Johnson to say a little more about it. And what she said was, look, I can't go anyplace else in New York City or to the suburbs and talk to anybody about my community, because the minute I say the word South Bronx, a whole lot of ideas and images come into people's heads. Right? Does this work for you? Are we too far from the South Bronx for you to have this work? It also works for places like Tacoma, doesn't it? What are the images that come to mind when you say Tacoma, if you're in the Seattle area?
It used to be it smells.
Smells? Or the South Bronx. Say that South Bronx doesn't smell.
Crime.
Violence. Mm-hmm. Yep. We started thinking about that. And we started thinking, what Mrs. Johnson is telling us about is like this. It's like a neighborhood needs map. It's like we have in our heads when we say the word South Bronx or public housing or Tacoma or Salishan, that we have a kind of map of the mind that appears magically. Whole set of images that are powerful and consistent. And they're all about needs and problems and deficiencies, crime and child abuse and welfare recipients and broken families and slum housing and unemployment and truancy and illiteracy and so on and so on. Right? You see what she's saying? She's saying it's a prison. She's saying this idea about the South Bronx and about communities, I think, now across the country. Now, we've learned this from people in the most challenged communities. We're beginning to see that some of it spills over into other communities as well. Now, let me do one thing that we've learned to do with the wisdom that Mrs. Johnson taught us. And one other sort of symbol that's become, in a simple-minded way, the center of a lot of this work. Everybody see this? Mm-hmm. All right? Know what it is? If I take one more sip out of it, it's the proverbial glass, right? It's half full and it's half empty. This glass, half full and half empty, all I want to remind us of here today, this is something you already know, by the way, right? Is exactly like everybody in this room, right? This is good Lutheran theology, too, by the way. Everybody in this room is like this glass. That is, everybody in this room has some fullness about us, some skills and some resources and some knowledge, gifts. And everybody in this room also, I think, when we are in our confessional mode, will admit that we've got some emptiness about us, some problems and some needs and some deficiencies. Sometimes I talk, and they know I do this, I talk about these professors I work with at Northwestern University, right? They are some of the most needy, deficient, problematic people you will ever see in your lives, these professors. I'm sure they're different at PLU and places like that. But boy, I mean, I work with a crew that is just so, they're a mess. They're people who can't keep marriages together. They're people whose children don't talk to them. They're people who drink too much. They're people who, lots of people with health problems. We have two people at the Center for Urban Affairs now who are fighting cancer, right? Just that they are a mess. What I am constantly reminded of, though, is that we at Holden, and you in an organization that you work in, if it works, and me at Northwestern University, and Ingrid at Urban Studies, and we are all part of a vast conspiracy, right? And the conspiracy is, even though we know we could ask people at Northwestern University to come to work at 8 o'clock in the morning on Monday and to bring their emptiness to the table, bring their problems to the table, we know that that wouldn't be the most helpful thing we could do to run a university. We know we could run a nonstop therapy group, but we probably couldn't run a university. and that if we wanted to run a university, we would have to conspire together to ask people to come together on Monday morning with their gifts. The fact that they're good teachers and good writers and can frame a research topic, that's what makes a university go. What I've learned over and over again is the simple truth about communities, that they have always, through the history of humankind, been built on the strengths, capacities, skills, and gifts of people who are also highly deficient and needy and problematic. We are all both. And the question for community builders is, which half do we focus on first? Do we focus on the fullness or on the emptiness? If we want to make sure communities never get built, we will focus first on the emptiness. What's wrong with the map?
It's all emptiness.
It's all emptiness. The map says to Mrs. Johnson and her neighbors in the South Bronx and across the United States, you know what? The only important thing about you is what you don't have. It's your deficiencies and your needs and your problems and your emptiness. And we have constructed, I will now suggest, over the last 40 years, from the best of intentions, a huge set of systems and institutions funded by billions of dollars, crossing all sectors, to say to Mrs. Johnson, broadcast your emptiness, tell us about your deficiencies, trumpet your needs, and we will give you money. But that's the system we've been involved in. Mrs. Johnson
only,
now
the
thinks...
The only way they're going to get money.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think we've all been part of it, right? I think this map gets drawn not by Mrs. Johnson and her neighbors, but by some of the most powerful institutions in our culture. Universities draw this map. Somebody once found that my doctorate was in social sciences, right? And they said, you know what you are? You are one of those quantifiers of misery. Right? And I think that's right. That's what social sciences do. We mostly study this stuff in depth, and we want to make sure that we understand the depth of the problems and their interrelationships, right? That's what social science does. So universities draw this map. Who else draws the map, do you suppose?
Government.
Government does, absolutely.
Churches.
Churches probably do. Churches need needs, funders, foundations, United Ways. I bet there are a bunch of people in here like me who have done, at some point in your life, a needs survey or a, yes? I've sworn off needs surveys. I think in this context, I will never do another one. And it is because a needs survey is, number one, about the useless part of the glass, and it's never news to community folks. And number two, it has to be understood as a request, a demand for people with power and resources to people with less power and fewer resources to broadcast their emptiness in order to get the money. That's the game. That's the dance that we've set up. Just devastating.
You know, physicians do that too, looking at problems, illness rather than health.
Absolutely.
And so it occurs everywhere around the world.
I think that's right. In fact, a lot of the language about what to do about social problems is translated from the medical world, right?
Pathology.
Absolutely.
We study pathology, we don't study health.
Absolutely. Diagnosis is a word that we get from the medical world that is about finding emptiness in somebody, right? That's what diagnosis is about. Absolutely. It's also interpersonal. Yeah. Well, I now think, I'm absolutely convinced that Mrs. Johnson's right, that the relentless focus on deficiency represented by this map is a prison for a whole lot of our communities. And let me just say a word or two about how the prison works, because I think it's part of our lives every day. The worst possible consequence of this map and its power, I think now, is that folks in communities occasionally begin to think it's true about themselves, right? I mean, Mrs. Johnson and her neighbors, they didn't draw this map about themselves, but they hear it so often about their reality that they begin to say, that's right, we must be empty, needy, deficient, and problematic people. That's who we are. And we can't possibly know how to raise our children. Right? We need to know better than us. We can't possibly make a safe neighborhood. We need help from people who are uniformed, credentialed, and armed from the outside to be able to do that. We can't make ourselves healthy. We need more and more help from people who are expert at this stuff, because we don't know. We have no idea. And that is a devastating cycle, right, of continuing dependency. Word or two more about this map. I am now convinced that this map determines a whole lot about the flow of dollars in our community. Dollars come in these boxes. It's called categorical funding, and a whole lot of people are organizing against that because communities know that if these problems are real, they're all interrelated. Right? this map also determines who gets the money. Quick story. 9 years ago, some friends of ours in communities in Chicago came to us at the Center for Urban Affairs with a proposition. They said, we think there's a lot of money coming into our neighborhoods. These were folks living in low-income neighborhoods. A lot of money coming into our neighborhoods targeted to help low-income people. Would you guys help us find out how much is coming into our neighborhoods targeted to help low-income people? Well, that turned out to be tougher than we thought it was going to be to do. I won't go into the methodological problems, but we tried to find out. 9 years ago, a family of four was designated officially poor if they earned $12,400 or less. Right? That's the poverty line 9 years ago. What we found, counting very conservatively in the Chicago area, was that for every poor family of four coming into Chicago, there was about $25,000 targeted to help poor people. Public dollars targeted to help poor people per family of four, right? About twice the poverty level, not the Ritz, but something you could live on, right? Well, you know the rest of that story probably, don't you, right? Of the $25,000 coming in to help poor people, how much do you suppose poor people saw? About $7,000 made it to poor people's hands. And the other $18,000 went to people, mostly whose job it was to find and treat empty and broken folk, right? Who had credentials and power to do that, right? You see what's happening here? Now, I think some of that work probably that's paid for by the $18,000 is probably good work, but I do think there's a slip between the intent and the outcome, right? And that's the slip we're trying to work on here. It's the gap between the intent and the outcome. Let me report, when we fed that number back into our community friends, let me tell you what they said to us. They said, Jody, we knew that in general, but specifically what you've proved is that it only takes one good poor neighborhood to support two middle class ones. Now, that's a really cynical point of view, and I don't want to get that cynical myself, but it is a point of view, I think, that captures, I think, some of the problems that we're facing here. Final thing I want to say about this map. I now think, for me, the power and the ubiquity, the monopoly power of this map helps me to understand why so many people in the United States get so hopeless about ever doing anything effective, right? And I mean hopeless if I'm a 16-year-old on the street corner or if I'm Bill Clinton in the White House. If I'm a 16-year-old on the street corner in Chicago or New York or Tacoma, and I think this is my community reality, why would I invest in my future? Why would I stay in school? This is not a place with a future. I don't have a future here. Why would I not take the quick drug money? It's the rational choice, right? Clearly the rational choice. Similarly, if I'm either Newt Gingrich or Bill Clinton, and for these purposes, I don't think it makes much difference. For other purposes, it does. But if I think this is the reality of cities, or of Native people's reservations, or of Appalachia, or of farm country that's in trouble, or of public housing, why would I not recognize every time somebody comes to me and asks for more money, what they're really asking for is more resources poured down an ever-deepening pit? Because I recognize that this is a system that is designed, couldn't be designed better. This is a system designed to reward failure. It's designed to say to folks, you have to come back next year and say, you know, we did everything we could, but crime just got worse. Give us more money. Right? It rewards failure. And from the point of view of Washington or the point of view of institutions and systems stretched beyond their resources at this point, that is a strategy that makes less and less sense. You see? And as long as they think this is the reality, I don't think either Gingrich or Clinton will think that anything effective can ever be done. Now, as we're wrapping up, what I want to say is that if any part of this introduction to the needs map made sense to you, you will be as pleased and excited as we have been to find that in these hundreds and hundreds of success stories, one of the things they have in common is some folks involved. They may not use this language exactly, but some folks involved who have said with my friend Mrs. Johnson, you know what, this is somebody else's idea about who we are. And what we'll do is tear it up, throw it out, never use it again, and construct our own map. Construct a map of the assets and strengths and capacities of our neighborhood. And this is one representation of a community assets map. And for the rest of the week in the sessions, what I'd like to do is to sort of tell stories about the last couple of years of traveling around the United States, watching communities draw their own rich version of this generic map. This is a poor, thin, generic version of what people see when they change glasses. If the old glasses pointed us relentlessly to emptiness, what we need is a new pair that points us towards fullness. This one suggests that there are three in any community, what you're going to find is a unique combination of assets and strengths. But at least these three categories of assets are in every community. This suggests that at the center of every community are the people who live there, the gifts of individuals. And when we've looked in public housing and places where people are generally regarded as not having any gifts or resources, what we find is exactly the opposite. The first time we looked for the resources and skills of people in public housing, we found six women, all of whom said they were the best soul food cooks in the city. And those women then were convened, brought together, started sharing recipes, started cooking together. People smelled what they were cooking. They were invited to cook for church suppers and PTAs. And that was about 6 years ago, and those women now have in that city the largest catering business in their part of town. And they employ 15 other folks. And these were folks who were on AFDC and were assumed to be giftless, right? Because nobody had ever asked, what skills do you have? And so I want to talk some in the session on Thursday about how communities are rediscovering and mobilizing the gifts of the people who live there, particularly people who have been regarded as empty and needy and deficient and pushed to the margins of our communities because that's how they've been regarded. The map also suggests that those gifts are magnified most effectively by what I now think is the most underutilized set of powerful community building tools we have, and that is the voluntary sector, where the churches are. All of the space that we have in communities where people come together, our block clubs and our choirs and our softball teams and all the stuff we all do, but we have not thought creatively enough about what that space is about as community building material, right? We used to assume our communities, and what we're finding is we can't do that anymore. We have to be more and more intentional and committed about building communities. So this associational space is something that I want to explore on Friday. And then finally, the outer ring says if every community has some sort of combination of local institutions, places where people get paid to do the work, whether it's schools and businesses and parks and libraries and so forth. But lots of those places aren't involved in the community building project at all. How can they be reignited as community building tools? What's the process of doing that? For the last 2 years since the Green Book came out, you know what's been funny about this is that we thought we were going to go on the road for 3.5 years, collect stories, try to think with people what they meant, write a book about it, try to write it in as simple-minded a way as we possibly could so it was actually usable for people. This is a non-academic book. And get it out there and our work would be done. We thought, well, then we can do something else. But what happened was that was just the beginning of the work. And that this thing, Ron, has just sort of taken off. And there are tens of thousands of these dumb things around now in various sectors. Because I think what's happening is that as the 21st century dawns, people all across not only the United States, but Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union and South Africa and developing countries are once again asking the question, what is community and what do we need it for and how do we invest in it and how do we understand it and how in modern technological society, when we can't assume it any longer, how do we get better at making sure it happens in a strong way for everybody? So what's happened is that we've sort of been swept up, I think, in a piece of work that has taken off and has I think gone in so many interesting and rich directions that we are learning on an hourly basis almost from what people are doing. So that's where the discussion's going. I'm sorry I ended up talking almost the whole hour here, but I did want to get at least the basics out. We got time for just a quick response. Not yet.
No, was it before?
Are you familiar with, in our community, there's a process of community development called JMP, Joint Ministry Project?
Yes. In Minneapolis? You're from Minneapolis?
Right.
Yeah, we've worked with them. Mm-hmm. Sal Miranda and the crew?
Right. Yeah. But is that kind of some of what you do, or is that...
Well, that's a sister...
And I find out that that's kind of out of the Sal Minsky.
That's right. We should talk, I think it's at probably... it fits best in terms of the sequence that I was thinking about in Friday's session about that, if you're still going to be around. But there, let me just ask, how many people here are involved in some version of community organizing? Right, maybe we ought to have a caucus about this. And so, would you? Yeah, we've got some people doing it. Church-based community organizing obviously has just exploded over the last decade in the United States. And there are now 5 major networks of church-based organizers across the United States. And we're in touch with all of them about this work, and we're in some tension with them about the work, but it's also work which fits in lots of ways. And as an old organizer, I would love to talk with those of you who are now doing community organizing about how it fits. Sure. Yeah, we can try to, let's caucus a little bit, find a time. Ron?
Yeah, I want to, it was in this room that, I don't know when you put out the original mapping community capacity to use the needs and the assets.
Mm-hmm.
When was that?
It was about 5 years ago, I think, Ron.
5 years ago, I was having a real problem in the east side of Tacoma. It's not like the South Bronx, which I go to every year. It's a pilgrimage. It'd be fun to talk about that someday. But it was there that you presented that original concept. And I remember how I was struck. Now I have the interpretive tool. What happened, I worked at PLU, and I knew our system. I knew it so well. And we even called the University Salesham. It's how we design. I didn't even talk about poverty. Just talk about how do you design an institution like Pacific Lutheran University, St. Olaf College. And it's very interesting to look at what we provide so that the strengths and the capacities, you don't ever say we got needy students to corporate people give you $50. They won't give you a dime. You say the other, which is true. Mm-hmm. It's also true that there's needs.
Yeah.
So as good theologians, this is what John is very modest. The back of that careless society is worth the price of the book. And I say that not to lift up John here. McKnight stuff is just, you'll get so mad at him anyway. You better have something to cool you off a little. There's one thing on just community in the back, and I just want to say that if it fits that person's question over there. And for $13, that's a bargain in words that will really be able to be used. It'll help, because every Lutheran, I'm a Lutheran, I'm a Russian Orthodox, I'd rather be that, but I happen to be an adopted Lutheran. So, as the Orthodox, they have images, you know, they see things, they smell things. Lutherans, they just sit there waiting for this grand pastor to inform them. Which we hardly ever do. But anyway, it was the interpretation. It was an incredible interpretation. Everyone, I went to every single Lutheran church, and it was through Holly Plain and Carol Plain and Peace Lutheran that we got started. It was their vision. And I went to everyone after every service, because we worshiped in the afternoon. There was no community space for morning worship. And we were committed to it no matter who came. It was people, good people, like ourselves here, came up to me and said, "Well, Pastor Ron, what do you need? What do your people need?" And I would always look at them. "Ted, what do they need?" I mean, I can tell them all kinds of things they need. But it was not what my experience was with the very people that were imaged on that need survey.
Yeah.
And I could not, for the life of me, figure out how can I tell them we got all these very gifted people here and without them not giving us the money. And I wouldn't lie about it, so I would never tell them what I needed. I said, "Well, you can come down here and you decide what we need. I don't know what we need." And it was only a very slow process.
Yeah.
And that book and that concept changed my whole ministry of development and organizing. Because then I could actually, I could see with the, and I will use biblical language, because it's very, his chapters are biblically and theologically sound, right to the core. You could, it's the Jesus story all over again. I just want to say this because when you read about Jesus, he's always saying to somebody sick, the needy, as we call them, he says, get up, woman, you're healed. And everybody's rejoicing except the powers to be, who control everything. And when that woman gets healed, she's rejoicing, the crowd is rejoicing, and it's only the institutions of religion and law and education that were terribly disturbed. Okay, and so for $13, you got a good buy. And the other one, this woman here, did you get find the price?
Oh, yeah.
How much is it?
15.
See, it's 15. That's even cheap.
The green one. Which one are you pitching, Ron?
How much do you pay you, Ron? I get a percent.
I don't think so. Let me, for the sake of tape ministry, officially say that we should sort of formally split at this point. But we do have, you know, 10 minutes before, 15 minutes before lunch. And if anybody wants to hang around and chat more about this, I'd be happy to do that. So thank you, tape ministry.
And officially, you can go.
Okay.